Well, now here's something that is growing in support, that our sun has a binary partner, and it may affect the Earth. Now, before you think this is crazy, I want you to sit back and listen to our guest, Dr. Barry Wormkessel, because his theory is now being shared by a number of others that there is indeed a dark partner to our sun. Now, what does that mean to us now? What has it meant to us in the past? That's our show tonight on Coast to Coast AM. I think I said, by the way, that the hurricane season ends the end of October. No, no, it ends the end of November, okay? Dr. Barry Wormkessel received his BA degree in physics from Pomona College and a PhD in physics from Arizona State University. He has been involved with the defense and aerospace industry for 31 years, and he has been a professional, experienced person with radar communications, electro-optic, electronic warfare, and airborne reconnaissance. He has several websites available. They're linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'll spell them out for you a little bit later on in the program. Was a guest on our program with me back in November of 2004, and is back as we talk about this incredible story of our sun having a binary partner. Barry, welcome back. How are you, doctor?
Very good, thank you.
My pleasure. Now, explain to us, first of all, what does this mean by binary partner?
Well, it was, I believe, George Gatewood, astronomer George Gatewood, that first came up with the idea that maybe most stars are binaries. And a lot of stars, we can see the binary companions or the double star system because both stars are ignited. In our case, our hypothetical binary companion, which I actually believe does exist, is what's called a brown dwarf star or a dark star. And usually they're thought to be on the order of maybe 5% solar mass. But I believe in our case, it's a very, very small one, maybe half the size of Jupiter.
Okay. All right, so, and when you say it is dark, that means it has it is emitting no energy like our sun at all. What's its mass like, Barry? I mean, is it solid? Does it have rock on it? What is that if it's dark?
We think it is mostly heavy elements. We don't think it's cloudy. We think it's magnitude about 21 or 22, so it's a very, very, very faint object. It's not something you can see with your store-bought telescopes, even the very good ones that amateur astronomers use, or at least we don't think it can be seen by such telescopes. It would take a very large telescope, like a 100-inch telescope or above, to see it, and even they would have to make a whole night exposure. As to what's covering it, well, with my luck, it'll be black or red. we don't know what it's really made of, other than we suspect it's made of mostly heavy elements. That means it's made up of elements that are not hydrogen or not helium.
Now, there are a number of theorists and physicists who believe exactly the way you do, that this sun has a partner. So you're not alone in this anymore. It's growing, isn't it?
Right. It's growing. But perhaps we are just a little bit different than the bulk of the other people that feel that way, in that we think that for planetary systems to form around stars, they don't form in the conventional way of just simple dust cloud condensation, as has been espoused for years in the astronomical community. We think that they're formed with the aid of the companion star, in this case our unlit companion star, which we've dubbed Vulcan, who really the name was taken from Madame Blavatsky's work, and she was the one that kind of tipped us off to this, and she was the one that suggested that the planets are seeded, and we agree with her, and we've built a theory around this, with the seeds being Dr. Stephen Hawking, the great British physicist, his primordial black holes. And this core theory pervades our thesis of both planetary formation, the existence of Vulcan, and nominally what orbital inclination and things like that it should be found at.
Vulcan, huh? How'd we get that name specifically from her? Because is that where they picked it up for Star Trek?
Well,
isn't that where Spock was from?
I think that Star Trek did adopt that idea, that concept. But Madam, and astronomically, astronomers used to feel that Vulcan existed as a planet, but it existed in between Mercury and the Sun. So it was very, very close to the Sun because its name implied warmth or heat. But we adopted the name Vulcan because we initially approached this problem by trying to see how it might affect what's called avatars. And this is a very new approach, but it all winds up it all boils down to the same thing. We're trying to get the orbit elements for Vulcan. And the orbit elements, of course, are the mathematical quantities that describe how Vulcan moves about the Sun. And in this case, we needed some data from the avatars, and that's how we initially approached the problem. We don't have access to huge telescopes like astronomers have, so we can't really point it at Vulcan, and indeed, even if we did have them, there'd be some doubt if we could actually get time on the telescopes to point or to search the sky where we think it would be.
And Barry, you're no slouch. I mean, you've got a PhD, you're a doctor, you've got this degree in physics. I mean, you're pretty credentialed for you to believe this and some others in your field to begin to believe this. Somebody's got to start noticing this, and you know, we start moving these telescopes one way or another to see if we can find Vulcan, right?
Well, it would be very, very handy to do so, and I believe there was actually a dedicated search for it back in the early 1980s, and it was they used the IRIS satellite to look for it, and the IRIS satellite. There's a children's encyclopedia, it turns out. I guess the new Science and Invention Encyclopedia that has an actual illustration of what we call Vulcan. They call it a dead star and Planet X. And in that encyclopedia, they have this dead star depicted as a body about 50 billion miles away. And if you compare that to our Vulcan at Aphelion, our Vulcan at Aphelion is about 41 billion miles away. So these two numbers are more or less coincident for a body that's hypothetical at this point. They also have a body called Planet X. And Planet X is depicted as being 4.7 billion miles away. That turns out to be about 50 astronomical units.
I want to talk with you about that and Vulcan tonight, Barry,
okay,
because Planet X has haunted a lot of us over the past few years, not really appearing, but a lot of people believe it's out there. And we're going to have to pull out some of the past work of Zechariah Sitchin when we talk about Planet X tonight as well. Now, in this particular case, and we'll call it Vulcan tonight.
Okay.
Did it ever fire up as a star in its infancy?
We don't think so. We think its mass is really far, far, far too low for it to have ever radiated by hydrogen ignition or even by gravitational contraction. Gravitational contraction of a star is another way for it to emit energy. But this body is just too small. Our estimates originally started out, like I said, about 5% solar mass. And as our work progressed, they quickly decreased to about the mass of Jupiter and then to about half the mass of Jupiter.
Where do you think it might be?
We think it is near an IRIS object. And the object is about 17 hours. Let me see. It's about 17 hours right ascension, and maybe 17.
Well, in layman's terms, like the sun is 93 million miles from Earth. How far do you think this thing?
How far away is Vulcan?
Yeah,
it is probably fairly close to aphelion now. We think it passed aphelion in 1970 at about 448 astronomical units. An astronomical unit being the distance from the Earth to the sun. Now it's a little less, but not much. Maybe 447 or 446.
So 447 times 93 million.
Right.
Would tell us how far this is. So
that's
would
correct.
Be what, three?
About 41 billion.
41 billion miles away.
Yeah, thereabouts.
And that would still be in our solar system?
Yes. That really is not too far away. I know it does seem far away, but they're finding objects that are practically at that distance now. And for example, some of the planets that Vulcan formed planets as well as the sun, and there are astronomers now that are thinking that these things that we're finding that are called large Kuiper belt objects are planets of a dark star. And in fact, they even say that they're planets of a brown dwarf star. They're a little bit more precise in their language.
But, well, if this thing is 31 billion miles away or 40 billion miles away, why do you think it's a binary partner? Why can't it be a planet out there?
Well, it is almost like a planet, and there is certainly some confusion, except that in this case, we think it was instrumental in the formation of the planets in our own system, as opposed to other bodies like Neptune, that might be thought of as children of the sun. These other bodies, like the newly discovered 10th planet or Pluto, and in particular a body called 2000 CR105,
that's a comet, isn't it?
That's classed as a super large comet. It's about 400 kilometers in diameter. And it's these very bodies that astronomers are saying are the children of a dark star, or were captured. They're called alien planets.
Okay, but if Vulcan were a planet, would it still have the same characteristics that a binary star has? Would it still capture other objects? Like you're saying, this binary star might be doing, would a planet have those kinds of abilities?
It's very debatable whether you call it a planet or a star just based on its mass, because it's half the size of Jupiter, and we call Jupiter a planet. But Jupiter's in a pretty circular orbit. This body is pretty far away, and it's at a highly inclined angle. Highly inclined angle to the normal ecliptic plane, the plane in which we find most of the recognizable planets. Pluto is starting to stray away from that inclination of about zero or a few degrees. Pluto's up about 17 degrees, but Vulcan we feel is on the order of 45 to 48 or 49 degrees. By the way, that orbital inclination is very similar now to this 10th planet UB313. That's existence, by the way, was allegedly kept secret, or believed to be kept secret.
This is the one that they announced a few months ago.
Yes, this is the one they announced a few months ago when a hacker broke into the website and threatened to release the data. So I guess that forced their hand. Because that's even designated as 2003 UB313, that lets you know that it was discovered in 2003.
Exactly. Good point.
And the interesting thing about that body, it is that the orbital inclination of that planet is about 45 degrees, within a few hundredths of a degree of 45 degrees.
All right. Well, let's, for the sake of this interview, at least for now, let's talk in two facets. One will be Vulcan as a binary partner to our own sun, and then we'll also talk about this possible Planet X and see what the ramifications that might have. Now, the question with the binary partner, what events have occurred that would lead us to believe that our sun has this binary partner?
Well, I guess there are two categories of events. First, there's a list of events that might be near and dear to your listeners' hearts that are basically sets of data from alien encounters one way or the other. And by that, I would categorize Sitchin's Acadian Seal. I would categorize the North Carolina case where a person was given a description of our solar system, including this dark star in it, and as well as a couple other planets. The Hill star map has it on it, if you know how to interpret it. This is one body of evidence that, oddly enough, goes back 4,500 years that would suggest that we have a dark star companion. There's another body of evidence that has to do with comet collisions with Earth. Basically, this dark star, being rather large compared to these other very tiny planets that they're discovering, sure, is very prolific about drawing in Kuiper Belt objects. And it essentially, as Vulcan goes around the sun in its elliptical orbit, it draws to a halt Kuiper Belt objects that are lazily drifting around the sun. And when their orbital motion is slowed or stopped, they fall literally like a stone towards the sun. The Kuiper Belt objects round the sun and break up. They start breaking up into the gravitational accelerations as they are hurled around the sun. So one big comet goes in, and you get two or three smaller comets coming out. And then in a particular case, what's called a resident orbit. And these are the very threatening orbits to Earth, because some of these cases, the comets are drawn in and they don't come anywhere near to the inner solar system. And that's, by the way, a case like CR-105. But in the cases where they come very close to the sun in a 3-2 resident orbits, those bodies stay in the solar system and they go out again and come back again, and they break up again rounding the sun. And this process continues roughly every 33,000 and some odd years, 3,300 and some odd years, and a comet swarm forms. And those comets, or a few comets of those comet swarms, occasionally will crash into Earth, and when they do, they change the weather.
Well, I want to say this, that the lost stars like this are very controversial, but astronomers are now agreeing that most stars are the likely part of a binary or multiple star system. Dr. Richard Muller, who's a professor of physics at UC Berkeley. Do you know him, by the way?
No, I don't.
Okay. He is a proponent of a companion star to our own sun. He prefers a 26-million-year orbit period. And there's another theorist who uses a 24,000-year period. What would you say about that?
Well, first of all, I compare it to Vulcan's period, which is about 5,000 years. Currently, we're carrying it at 4969 years. And obviously, this period is far shorter, far, far, far shorter than the values that these other gentlemen, these other professional astronomers are citing. I've been in communication with Dr. Van Flandren, and considering these comets, planets or dark stars or what have you, that are in excess of 2,000 AU around the sun. And apparently, according to classic astronomical theory, the passage of other stars by the sun in the ensuing billions of years since the formation of our solar system would have scattered these companions away from the solar system. So I really don't think that things exist, that bodies exist around our sun, based on this evidence, with 26-million-year periods.
All right, Barry, I'll tell you what. We will look more into this when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And with our special guest tonight, Dr. Barry Wormkessel, as we talk about theories, not just his anymore, about Vulcan, a binary star system tied into our own sun. We'll also talk about Planet X. Yes, here we go again, but this time a different twist on Planet X. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Barry, how long has it been since you came up with your own views about Vulcan?
I guess I started this work when we published a book called Astrometrics back in 1994. And at that time, I really wasn't at all concerned about the comet bombardment phenomenology. The gentleman that was helping me at that time was feeling that the body that we were looking for, that we did call Vulcan, would be in a circular orbit, and he rejected the highly elliptical orbits. After that time, I became more and more concerned that that Vulcan was really of a stellar origin type. And therefore, the body should be in a highly elliptical orbit. We re-looked at the data, and that's when we came up with the nominally 5,000-year orbit. Before, we were working with about a 700-year orbit. And so I guess it was in the very late 1980s to 1994 that we really took our fledgling step in this arena.
Has this object created catastrophes on planet Earth?
It hasn't passed anywhere near planet Earth or even the inner solar system. It doesn't even come within about 130 astronomical units of the sun, so it's even far away from Pluto. But it's the comets that form in these resonant orbits that cause the catastrophes. It's not the body itself. It's just this interaction with Kuiper Belt objects that cause the problem.
I see. Okay. Now, with these calamities, I assume some of them have occurred since the beginning of time. Have they been misconstrued, let's say, in the Bible for, truly spiritual events as opposed to really solar system universal events?
Let me take the first part of your question before I deal with the second part. The first part about them happening from the beginning of time, it's kind of yes and no, but it's an off-or-on process. Basically, the Kuiper Belt objects are drawn into these resonant orbits. They fracture as they go around the sun every 3,000 years or so until they really a swarm builds up. Eventually, they collide with planets, or they're scattered out of the solar system by interaction with Jupiter. And the whole thing will kind of disappear, like maybe in 2 to 10 million years. And you may go on another 100 million years before another object is drawn in, and then the process will repeat, and then they'll stay around for maybe 2 to 10 million years again until they're dissipated one way or another. The comets do not exist in stable orbits. You can't have these cometary orbits coming into the solar system and lasting for a long period of time indefinitely. Things just happen to them that take them out of the solar system, either by direct collision or scattering. That being said, we think one entered our solar system approximately 2.1 million years ago and changed our weather conditions from the Pliocene to the Pleistocene, in other words, to the Ice Age. They started initiating ice ages, and so they've been whacking us ever since, periodically. Sometimes it's a big whack, and sometimes it's a small whack. There's actually several of these orbits. There's four and maybe five of these orbits that can exist due to the nature of the geometry of the problem. These comets these impact events have been seen in and recorded in the Bible. The most notable one, of course, is Noah's flood, and that was postulated by Newton's assistant Winston and Halley of Halley Comet fame to be due to a comet collision. The Sodom and Gomorrah episode, that was another collision, maybe not of a comet, but of the fragments surrounding a comet. That's duly recorded in the Bible. There was the catastrophe in roughly 540 A.D., 536, 540 A.D. We suspect that was an event where a comet perhaps detonated in the atmosphere over northern Europe and took out 70 or 80% of the Chinese. It impacts Earth, not by so much by falling on you or even by the tsunami. It impacts the weather, and crops can't grow, and people are highly addicted to eating, and they starve to death. And that's the real problem with these collisions. Of course, because they change the weather, we see this. We see data in the tree rings, and tree rings turns out to be a very good way to date these events. And Dr. Mike Bailey, I believe he's in England. I'm not quite sure. I don't quite recall right now, but has done a fine job of categorizing these events back about 5,000 years.
Let me ask you if they can predict dates when other calamities then might occur because of all this. Can they?
Well, we certainly have tried to do that. And of course, being of a physics background, and my cohorts are somewhat of a physics background as well, we do it kind of the old-fashioned way by just calculating numbers and taking past events and adding the appropriate numbers on, coming up with new dates. The problem with this, of course, is that the past data is prone to have errors. Sometimes the errors are stated to be very large, like 100 years or so, but in actuality it might be only maybe 20 or 30 years. Because scientists tend to be a conservative crew. When we do this. In fact, we've tried this with the data surrounding Tolman's events, which was about 9,600 to 9,900 years ago. We have a very good orbit of Vulcan, which means we have a very good resonant orbit period for the comets, and they're not exactly periodic, because Vulcan affects the periods when the comets are more than 200 AU from the sun, which of course they do get to, because they have to pass near Vulcan.
Well, Barry, with these five comet swarms that occur periodically then through the inner solar system because of this small dark star companion, what's the possibility of some kind of impact threat to us, and would we see it coming?
Well, yes, but you might only get a few months' warning. The problem with comets is you see them out about the distance of Jupiter or the distance of the asteroid belt. At those distances, although not at that angle, they can be coming in from a more highly inclined angle. But that means you're only going to have like 3 to 5 months' warning. 3 months if they get you on the first pass. And 5 months, maybe, if they round the sun and get you coming back.
And would you say a comet is more devastating than an asteroid strike?
Actually, they were thought at one time to be about the same. The comets are faster, but the asteroids are denser because they tend to be made of metals or stone, whereas comets
stone
are,
or metal.
Comets tend to be like big snowdrifts. Maybe some of them have stony cores, some of them have metal cores, but there is a speed phenomenon. And then they being large snowdrifts, when they hit, they oftentimes tend to explode in the air. Of course, that's like a nuclear bomb. That's how a nuclear bomb is exploded.
That's exactly right. And the impact up there in the atmosphere is just as bad as a direct hit.
It might be worse. Either one is pretty bad. But when we project the numbers forward, from two events that we feel we have fairly good dates on back about 10,000 years ago, we're coming up with numbers like 2028 and another number at 2128.
What about 2012?
2012 is well within our error budget, because we don't get it to the nearest year. You know, the devil is in the details, and the details are the error budgets that are associated with the numbers that are 10,000 years old. We feel those numbers are in the order reasonably 35 years at least, 35 or 40 years. So you take 2028, which is roughly 2030. So from 1990 on, we've been in the dangerous period.
So it's possible then.
Huh?
It's possible that the Mayans knew something when they did their 2012 calendar.
Yes, but let me comment on that just a little further. Certainly, the Mayan calendar 2012 date has been around and has been very famous for some time. And I don't mean to belittle the date. I believe the date is a valid date. However, I believe it's LDS or Mormon doctrine. And I want to caveat that I am not a member of the church or a member of that faith even. But they do subscribe to the belief that the Israelis came to the New World about 600 years B.C. And if you look into the details of this, they started the Azapan culture, and the Azapan culture is the culture from whence the Mayans got the 2012 date. Now, the reason I say this is because the Hebrew Pentateuch and the Bible code data, when they decode people are decoding the Bible code, like Drosden in his book, or like Andy McCracken in England on his website, either one, and both are doing a fine job, I would like to comment on. But they also get the 2012 date. Now, I suspect that the 2012 date was carried by the Hebrews over to the Azapan culture, and the Mayans got it from the Azapan culture.
That's fascinating. It's
not bad that they did it, but it's bad because it's not double sourced. That means the source of the Mayan calendar is likely the same source as the Bible code date, and so that means it's single source. However, it's pretty hard to prove what I'm saying there, but there's a flavor of single sourceness in it. When you get a prediction, you like it to be double sourced or triple sourced. You like to be from several independent sources to say, yeah, we all are coming up with that same date. But I'm not so sure that the 2012 date is double sourced. However, the 2006 date, which is coming out of the Bible code, is in coincidence with the crop circle date of 2007. In fact, it's only a couple months into 2007.
Yeah. That's ironic all by itself.
Right. And the Bible code by itself is not going to be accurate to much more than a year. So you have to give the Bible code a little slop there. I mean, they say maybe 2006. Okay, that's 2005 or 2007. You know what I mean? And they also say 2012, but that could be 2011 or 2013. Certainly, there's that kind of error budget on those numbers.
I'm looking at your website at the orbit, for example, of Vulcan, and it looks very close to the orbit of the planet X, Nibiru, that Zechariah Sitchin has predicted. What are the possibilities that Sitchin's work and your work and others, that both of you may be talking about the same object?
I think we're certainly flirting with the same object. The difference between our concept and Sitchin's concept, as I understand it, is that Sitchin feels that his stuff can be seen from Earth as it whizzes by.
Yeah, it gets close. Very close.
And we do not think that is a large planet, because a large planet, if it whizzed by Earth, would be doing so every 3,000 or 3,600 years or whatever Sitchin quotes.
Right, 3,600 years.
Yeah, but over the eons since the beginning of time, or since the beginning of the solar system 5 billion years ago, there would be a lot of passes, and in those passes, either it or the Earth or Jupiter would be bounced out of the solar system. Well, we're still here, and Jupiter's still here, and so that would tend to be bounced out. That's over a course of time of billions of years. However, if it's comet swarms, if he's reporting comet swarms, which would be a very, very, very noticeable event. In fact, they would appear far bigger than planets appear. Those planets would, you know, those comets would only be in existence for like 2 to 10 million years.
Now, what's your definition of a comet swarm?
A comet swarm is just a bunch of comet-like fragments, some of which you can see and some of which you can't.
Okay.
And in this case, it's due to these Kuiper Belt objects, which seem to be very somewhat fragile, and they break up rounding the sun. And this is a well-known astronomical phenomenon. Astronomers see one comet go in one side of the sun, and they see two or three comets come out. And, of course, it's not the sun that's making comets. It's the sun that's breaking up the comet that went in. So this is a common, well-known, accepted theory, as far as I know, that the sun breaks up comets as they have close encounters with it,
or melts it down somewhat if they happen to be ice, right?
Or both, or a combination of both.
Well, I got to tell you, this entire theory of this possibility is exciting. I don't understand why mainstream media, NASA, others don't jump on board with this. How come?
Well, I can give you my opinion. I can't speak for the reasons they do and they don't. But if we are in danger of a comet swarm passing, which means most of the time, like more than 50% or maybe more than 80% of the time, we're going to get an impact of some magnitude. These things can change the direction of culture, of human culture. They could cause governments to go. They're a lot worse than wars. Even nuclear wars.
Well, are you saying that they might know about things they don't want to tell us?
Well, some people have accused them of doing that with aliens. So I certainly believe that the alien phenomena exists. It seems to me that aliens are very benign. I mean, the aliens aren't coming down here and bombing our cities or anything like that, at least as far as I know. But these comet swarms, these things are really dangerous. I think if it were commonly recognized that this phenomena exists, there could very possibly be a widespread panic.
Well, what's the next cycle for the next comet swarm? Do we know?
Well, according to us, and I want to just say I want to stress that this is according to us. We see the centroid to be 2028 and 2128. However, when we look at Tolman's work, he had seven impacts about 10,000 years ago. When we look at the Bible code, Andy McCracken did a lot of the search. I want to credit him with the work, with a lot of the really brutally hard work. We get roughly seven periods when comet swarms are going to pass. And I'll just try to rattle them off. They're like 2006, 2007, and then another one around 2010 to 2013, and another one 2015 to 16, and another one around 2030. It looks like a really bad one is going to be into 2044 to 2045, 2070, and the last one is 2130.
This is invaluable information, Barry. I mean, these projected dates are exactly what I think people need to be aware of.
Well, yes, and I guess that's one of the reasons that we bothered to put this work on our website. I'm supported by a lot of good people, and they're very, very, very talented people, far more talented than I am, I might add, especially technically. But they've done this work voluntarily to try to alert people, and a lot of them don't even want publicity. The Vulcan website has my name on it majorly, but it does credit all these people that are contributors.
Now, you said that you also believe there's a planet X in the solar system, another planet, not unlike the ones that we've already known about. Is that true?
Well, yes, and I guess... Now, of course, the astronomers are admitting that this UB 313 kind of qualifies as a planet, because.
But that's not what you're talking about, right?
I cannot make a firm correlation.
Hold that, because that's all I need to know right now until we come back at the top of the hour.